Going back to what we talked about, I'd rather be standing up, so I'm going to see if I'm lucky today. And this works. I know how well you can see this. Okay, so yeah, you can see very well, but everything seems like very dark. Okay, I'll do it like that. Okay, so it's only the Garo at home, so the Garo, we're in the dark right now. If you need anything, just type it there in the chat. As I was saying, New Historicism is about what Stephen Greenblatt called parallel reading. We're going to read a literary text and a non-literary text at the same time and in the similar fashion. The other day, you were reading the 12 o'clock news. 12 o'clock news has a structure where there is like a signed word and then there's a description that has very little to do with this word. In the case of the 12 o'clock news, it was all elements that were on a desk, and the text on this side seemed to describe a warfare situation. And at the same time, we had Mary McCarthy's a report from Vietnam, which had a very similar structure to this part over here. So what we saw here were Mary McCarthy's report that was very similar in structure to Elizabeth Bishop's poem. I think it's going to be a bit difficult to explain that. So I'll turn on the light once in a while to help you be able to take notes. Summarizing, New Historicism is about parallel reading. It was coined by Stephen Greenblatt. We're going to deal with part of his critical work. I don't know where the name of his essay this comes from. Yeah. In the study guide, at the beginning of the study guide, it gives us a few pointers. Exactly, yes. Stephen Greenblatt's Introduction to Power of Poems in the English Renaissance, and Hayden White's Historical Text as a Literary Artifact. Okay, we're going to read those two extracts today, and we're going to summarize New Historicism, and we're going to move on to cultural materialism. What is our definition for New Historicism? Our definition for New Historicism is a method based on parallel reading of the literary and non-literary text. What I was saying here, we read this at the same time and we extract conclusions. Now, usually we take them from the same literary, as the same historical period. This is one of the big differences with cultural materialism. They're from the same historical period. What is cultural materialism going to suggest? It's going to suggest comparing a literary text to a current, a contemporary text of our time. So that makes the interpretation run in a different direction. It's the same interpretation that we have when we want to analyze whether, for example, Edgar Allan Poe was a feminist or not. In modern terms, practically no author could survive the comparison and the standards that we have of current literature. So to establish new paradigms for old authors seems an unfair movement, but we're going to see that afterwards in cultural materialism, and we're going to see where the current fashion of doing that stems from. New historicism refuses a privilege, this is maybe a key passage, of the literary text, and it removes the literary foreground and the historical background and puts them at the same level. It's like if you bring the mountains to the foreground and you take the portrait and you put it at the same distance. They're given equal weight. Okay, that's a key element. I posted this presentation last week, so it's probably the forum. If you want to download it and print it out, okay. And if I'm didn't do it, just write me an email and I'll post it or I'll send it to you immediately. The paradox of new historicism. New historicism is paradoxical for some, standard is for most, in its approach to literature. No privileging of the literary text, which seems a weird way to approach in critical studies from literary experts. A new historical essay will place the literary text within the frame of a non-literary text. So the critical essays of new historicists are these historical essays that reevaluate the literary text in the light of a non-literary text. It's the same type of perception that we have when we put Elizabeth Bishop's 12 o'clock news next to the news report from Vietnam. Plays from the Renaissance period and colonialist policies of the time are put one next to the other in order to view works that seem innocent or even naive in the period in which other situations that were less edifying occurred at the same time. So, when you're tearing down your universal literature, what is your attempt? Why are you doing this? It would be the question that most of the scholars would ask new historicists. They want to refocus the attention of everyone from the main characters, from the heroes, from the dominant class, from this what we normally call the Western heterocentric patriarchal mainstream society, to the marginalized, shift the view to the marginalized, to the dehumanized, to the suppressed others, to these other dominated people. Instead of focusing on the U.S. Army, to focus on the Vietnamese Viet Cong, instead of focusing on the brilliant military victory, to focus on the people that are defeated and are annihilated by the bullying way of practicing warfare in Vietnam by the United States. New historicist essays normally forget intentionally all the academic preliminaries and all the published interpretations. Basically, they ignore everything that their colleagues said before them because they want to break away from the past and they want to reinterpret history in the light of a juxtaposed situation between the literary text and the co-text. Okay? Okay, so let's compare this new historicism with old historicism. New historicism, very simply, parallel study of literary and non-literary texts. Old historicism, hierarchical separation between literary texts, this is the dual, and the historical background, which is just decor, a prop, a title, as we would call it. Okay? The second one is the use of the word archival. New historicism is a historicist movement as opposed to historical. History is represented and recorded in written documents. And I think I focused very much on this. We can never recreate the past. We can only recreate the representation of the past and make interpretations based on what was written, but not on what really happened, because that is lost forever. And that's something that new historicism, I think it's a very valid point that new historicism makes and says, you cannot reevaluate anything that you have not experienced firsthand, because you do not have a firsthand experience. You can only recreate what other people wrote about what happened at that moment. You don't really know what happened, and there's probably another point of view that is as valid as yours. And that's what new historicism says. It says, this document says this, and this document says this. But it's not the world as it was, it's the word as it was. It evaluates the word of the past, not the world of the past. This is probably a key sentence. All historicism, a recall of historical events. There is always one mainstream version, like when you read a history book, everything seems so simple and so logical and so straightforward, There's only one version when Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon, and there is no version of why he crossed the Rubicon, or what the senators that were waiting in Rome thought about that, or what Julius Caesar did before crossing the Rubicon. So all of these elements, it changes the perspective in which we look at history. We look at history only through the literary text and the codex that have reached our time. Okay, and that's why the closer in time it is, the easier it is to look for contrasting information. The older it is in time, the less the more complicated it becomes to find codex that match with historical texts. So sometimes, in the case of, for example, Renaissance plays, it's going to compare Renaissance plays with works from the present that study, for example, the wardrobes of the past and put them in perspective and why people dress in a certain way. So sometimes the codex doesn't belong to the same period as the literary text because it's just not possible, okay, to find the literary text of that time. Okay, so deconstruction as a source for new historicism. There is a preference for the textual record of the past. There is a new historicism embraces a principle of post-structuralism, the principle that there is not summarized as there is nothing outside the text. You cannot evaluate or extract conclusions outside of what you have in the text. Everything that you can analyze has to be contained in the text. Everything about the past is only available for us in textualized form. And this textualized form, and this is interesting, is processed three times. Thrice processed. You know, the thrice is a word we don't normally use in English. It's kind of dated as a word. The ideology, I've always emphasized that story is written by the winners of wars, not by the losers. So the ideology of the winners is what is expressed in a history book, or in a historical document, or in a literary work. There's only going to be the opinion of the author that analyzed the facts and through his or her ideology wrote the text. At the same time, the outlook, the perspective that the person had about the events. Maybe the perspective was firsthand. Maybe the perspective was not exactly firsthand. Okay? I teach American literature. I think that most of you are going to do American literature next year. An example of this outlook of the time is most of the people, when evaluating the Native Americans of the 18th century or the 19th century, they always tend to look at the way that Native Americans or Indians were described by James Fenimore Cooper. James Fenimore Cooper is very famous for some novels, like, for example, The Last of the Mohicans. James Fenimore Cooper studied a lot about the Indians and Native Americans before writing this text. But he didn't have any first-hand experience. If we go to, have you already done the development of Dominican? If you go back to the captivity narratives, people that were captured by the Native Americans, you can see that Native Americans are not black and white. It's not, they're all terrible. Maybe they, at the beginning, because of the religious difference, they seem terrible, and their practices seem that they were acting as savage animals. But after some time among the Native Americans, they began to understand their reasons, the way they did, the way they interacted with other people. There was an understanding. For James Fenimore Cooper, that lived 100 years later and had no first-hand experience with Native Indians, Native Americans, with Indians, his process was very simple. He wanted to write good fiction. So he basically had two kinds of Indians, good Indians and bad Indians. The good ones were on my side, the bad Indians were on the other side. And that simplest way of creating a cliché for an entire culture was so powerful because so many people read his books many more people read his books than the Captivity Narratives, One Century Report, but that became the standard way of believing that the Native Americans were, and he had never spoken to a Native American. So this idea of the outlook of the person being able to create an image, I don't think that when Shakespeare wrote his plays about Italy, about Julius Caesar, about Romeo and Juliet, he had first-hand knowledge. He got a libretto or a book that he liked, he read it, and he created his own story. In that story, there was his outlook, his recreation of what happened in the time, and it had to fit the narrative. So sometimes when we write fiction, we are misconstruing, not intentionally, but in a very significant way, the way that people appear in front of society. The appearance that you might have of the Veronese is that they would kill for honor and they would die for love. And that's probably a mistaken or an incomplete version of the facts. Just to bring in some more text into what we have in the book. Yes, please.
So you say that this content is based on in the perception we have of things?
Everything that we read has three lenses on top that deform the reality. The first perception is our ideology. If for example, you see an immigrant crossing a border illegally, and you believe that immigrants should be assisted and helped and rescued, you will write it in a way. If on the other hand, you believe that you have to have strong borders and that those immigrants are probably going to steal your job and cash your money and not want to work and they're probably going to be criminals, the way you're going to construct that narrative is completely different. And that is your ideology. Another thing is whether you are a direct witness or you're just watching it on the TV and you're creating your image, or you read it in reports and you're creating your image in an indirect way. And the other one is the dispersive practices of the time. Every time has its own way of explaining things. For example, Romanticism, we know, because that's the way Romanticism was, that it was very dark in construction, difficult to read, and it had all of a sudden fantastic elements embedded in the story because it made sense to do that, because it was a time where that was the expectation of the readers. Afterwards, in realism, there was the opposite feeling, that the narrative had to be very well understood by almost everyone, that that the text had to be a contrast between man that is insignificant in the global scheme of things and the nature that is overpowering. In other periods of time, God was the explanation for everything. So the discursive practices of the time are very important. They're not so obvious as the outlook and the ideology, but they're also very important. What I want you to understand is that there is a triple processing in every historical text that we read, whether it's literary or whether it's a code text. Even the most innocent of texts have this type of lens applied to it. Okay? Finally, when I read it, I also have my ideology, my outlook, and the things that I'm used to reading and the things that I'm not used to reading. So I crossed it again three times. So what this says is that the information that reaches me is severely misconstructed or at least altered, both in my perception and the way it was written. Okay, so when it's processed by us, we go through the same process and we distort it, and when we represent it, maybe our capacity to represent it in words is not accurate enough, and we have to navigate through the web of language. So everything that we represent in a text is remade. This is a key word, remade. Every time we're representing a text that talks about history, is being remade. The aim is not to represent the past, but to present a new resituated reality. We cannot aspire to representing the past because of this excessive processing of the text. And New Historicism and Foucault. New Historicism is radically anti-establishment, anti-sistema. Okay? All of these movements are going to be anti-establishment to a certain extent. New Historicism is very, very anti-establishment. I would say it tends to be a leftist Marxist type of writing that departs from the mainstream, because the mainstream is the Western civilization. Everything that goes against the Western civilization, that goes against what we understand as the normal, is anti-establishment. So all of the normals that I have, that your parents had, that their parents had, has changed slightly over time. But the ideas of the 50s, of the 60s, of the 70s, of the 80s, of the 90s, question all of the pillars that we call the normal. So what all of these theories try to do is to reestablish, to rewrite a new normal, or to just destroy the previous normal. New Historicism is anti-establishment. It's always on the side of liberal ideals, of personal freedom, and it accepts difference and deviance. This is something that we're going to hear a lot. Deviant from normal. Deviant from normal. What is normal, actually? Okay. I don't know if you've ever seen Foucault's panoptic surveillance. I don't know if I have it in the slide. I think it's in the guide. Can you turn on the light for a second? I don't think it's going to be here in the picture, basically. Let me read from the book in the third edition. It's on page 169, probably in page 172 or so. In yours, it's New Historicism and Foucault. Okay, 178 in yours. New Historicism is resolutely anti-establishment. That's what we're saying here. It's always on the side of the liberals. Liberal ideas of personal freedom and accepting and celebrating all forms of difference and deviance. And afterwards it says, this notion of the I'm going to continue reading because it explains where this comes from. This celebration of difference and deviance is a way of surviving or reacting against a repressive state, against an establishment that is repressive. And the way it says it is, in the face of the power of the repressive state, which it constantly reveals as able to penetrate and taint the most intimate areas of personal life. This notion of the state as an all-powerful, all-seeing, very similar to the Big Brother concept that we read in George Orwell's 1984, stems from the post-structuralist cultural historian Michel Foucault, whose pervasive image of the state is that of the panoptic. A panoptic is like an eye that can see everything. Clear. An eye with legs. I'll show you a picture now. Meaning all-seeing surveillance. The panopticon was a design for a circular prison conceived by the 18th century utilitarian Jeremy Bentham. The design consisted of a tiered rank of cells which can all be seen surveyed by a single warder positioned at the center of the circle. The panoptic state, however, maintains its surveillance not by physical force and intimidation, but by its power of its discursive practices. To use Foucault's terminology, discursive is the adjective derived from the noun discourse, which circulates its ideology throughout the body politic. Okay, so before I continue, let me show you a picture of that panopticon. This is the image of the prison that was invented. Okay, wait. This is the concept of the prison, of a panopticon prison. And to symbolize this, there is another image that is sort of a playful form. I'll copy the link for the gallery at home. As you can see, there is one single ward that is surveilling everyone in the prison. And the way of controlling everyone is not through force, but through the feeling that they are doing the correct thing to stay in their cells. So it's a discursive practice. It's like the idea that you live in a prison, and if you've read 1984, you can see that it's a paranoia of the time to feel governed and oppressed and controlled by the state, by a repressive state. I don't know if I can. I think this is Emerson. No, I can't see it. No, I can't find that. I'll look for it and bring it to the next class so you can see it. I'm going to put this in the chat for Ricardo to see. Okay, well, let's continue. New historicism is seen as a way of fighting against the control. As you can see, everything that I'm saying is in the book. I'm just summarizing it in a, I think, a bit easier way to remember. But anyway, read the unit so you extract your own conclusions and complete whatever you think I might be missing or not dealing with sufficiently. The discursive practice of the power is to circulate the official discourse. This idea that we're brainwashed by an official message and that message is so pervasive that we see it as the only natural way of acting, and everything that isn't that message is deviant or different. Okay? So the idea of different is celebrated in New Historicism as a rebellion against the discursive practice of the power. New historicism is a way of fighting against thought control. New historicism believes. New historicism believes in intensive close reading. This is also very deconstructionist and it feels very similar to post-structuralism at this point, focusing on extracts of text. The problem that both post-structuralism and new historicism has is that close reading is very narrow, and therefore you can't read 300 pages in close reading. You normally focus on small extracts of the story, whatever is convenient for your essay. So at the end of the day, both post-structuralism and new historicism have that flaw, that it's like looking for the text that suits your purposes and explains your ideas. So those were the basic flaws that critics to this theory extracted. Advantages and disadvantages of new historicism. The appeal of new historicism is great. It's founded on post-structuralism, so it appeals to all the late post-structuralists. It's more accessible because it's easier to understand. It's less dense. It presents data and draws conclusions. The material itself, as we saw in the 12 o'clock news, it was fair, once you understood what the poem did, it was fairly easy to understand the poem, and once you put it in juxtaposition with the report, it became even clearer that it was a game that the poet was playing to replicate the structure of a war report, of Telequipo, the war dispatch. So sometimes the material itself is fascinating. The political edge avoids problems encountered by other criticism. It's more willing to allow historical evidence its own voice. It doesn't deny historical facts, but it questions some of the conclusions that are extracted from the historical evidence. So at the same time, it's not as radical as post-structuralism, and it becomes more appealing to the readership. Cultural materialism. Probably going to turn on the light and read from the book so you are able to follow this. You guys have heard words in a while. In my book, this is yours, 184. It was 175 in mine. Okay, so before we get there, go one page back, and I think to illustrate what we said before, what new historicists do, it's on the previous slide. I think it's interesting to repeat this part. What new historicists do is juxtapose literary and non-literary texts, reading the former in the light of the latter. The first one is juxtapose literary and non-literary. The second thing that they do is defamiliarize, or they see it as new. They try thereby to defamiliarize the canonical literary text. They try to strip it from the ideology, from your perspective, from everything, detaching it from the accumulated weight of previous literary scholarship and seeing it as if it was new. Number three, they focus on state power and the patriarchal system. They focus the attention within both the text and the co-text on issues of state power and how it is maintained, on patriarchal structures and their perpetuation, and on the process of colonization with its accompanying mindset. The fourth would be aspects of post-structuralist outlook. They make use, in doing so, of aspects of the post-structuralist outlook, especially Derrida's notion that every facet of reality is textualized, and Foucault's idea of social structures as determined by dominant discursive practices. Okay, we're not going to follow the rest of the text linearly. We're going to ask you to go to page 184, and let's focus on cultural materialism. The British critic Graham Holderness describes cultural materialism as a politicized form of historiography. We can explain this as meaning the study of historical material, which includes literary texts, within a politicized framework. This framework, including the present, which those literary texts have in some way helped to shape. So why would you bring co-text from the present? Because the present is shaped by the text of the past. And that's the explanation for bringing text of the present to the past. The term cultural materialism was made current in 1985 when it was used by Jonathan Dolimore and Alan Dixinfield, the best known of the cultural materialists, as a subtitle of their edited collection of essays, Political Shakespeare. They define the term in a foreword as designating a critical method which has four characteristics. It combines an attention to historical context, theoretical method, political commitment, and textual analysis. Historical context undermines the transcendent significance traditionally accorded to the literary text. Here the word transcendent roughly means timeless. The position taken, of course, needs to face obvious objection that if we are still today, that we are today still studying and reading Shakespeare, then his plays have indeed proved themselves timeless, in the simple sense that they are clearly not limited by the historical circumstances in which they were produced. But this is a matter of degree. The aim of this aspect of cultural materialism is to allow the literary text to recover its histories, which previous kind of studies have often ignored. The kind of history recovered would involve relating the plays to such phenomena as enclosures and the oppression of the rural poor, state power and resistance to it, witchcraft, the challenge and containment of carnivalesque. Secondly, so this would be the second point. The first one is historical context. The second one is the emphasis on theoretical method, signifies a break with liberal humanism and absorbing the lessons of structuralism, post-structuralism, and other approaches which have become prominent since the 1970s. So basically what this cultural materialism does is it breaks with liberal humanism. Liberal humanism was the way that we analyze text classically. Thirdly, the emphasis on political commitment signifies the influence of Marxist and feminist perspectives and breaks from the conservative Christian framework which hitherto dominated Shakespeare criticism. Finally, the stress on textual analysis locates the critic of traditional approaches where it cannot be ignored. In other words, there is a commitment not just to making theory of an abstract kind, but to practicing it on mainly canonical texts, which continue to be the focus of the massive amounts of academic and professional attention, and which are prominent national and cultural icons. So, to recap on cultural materialism, it was developed or made current in 1985 with this work on Shakespeare. It is a politicized form of historicism. It studies historical material, including literary texts. And these are the four features that we talked about: historical context, theoretical method, political commitment, and textual analysis. Okay? And then one final slide of this presentation. I'll go back to the book before we read the extracts from the essays. Would be the very clear differences between cultural materialism and new historicism. The differences between cultural materialism and new historicism, besides the place where they stem, cultural materialism is a European, highly politicized form of new historicism, which is previous and American. They differentiate one from the other in around 15 years, and the focus, we knew from new historicism that it focused on the problems of the people, the marginalized within the political situation of its own day. In contrast, the focus of cultural materialism is the present day because the texts of the past have shaped the reality of today. And the context is used as a comparison. The similarities that it brings, that both of them bring to the table, is there is a bigger attempt in cultural materialism to adapt to existing criticism, and there is the acceptance of new historicism of a particular version of post-structuralism. Cultural materialism is more embracing of structuralism and post-structuralism, and new historicism has a narrower point of view. The difference between the co-text is very significant. We know that new historicism took mainly text from the own time of the literary text. In the case of cultural materialism, because it's focused on the influence of the present day, it would be current documents. Okay? Last week you asked me about the pen, right? Do you know, many of you, it's your first year in a minute, no? No, it's not your first year. Is it your first year? No? You're like, yeah, okay. Basically, the important thing at Runet is to learn how to pass every subject. There is an exam deposit, it's called Calatayud, it's one of the centers, it's in Calatayud. There's another one in Barbastro, but if you Google, I'm going to do it right now, in fact, if you Google Calatayud, Depósito de Exámenes, you basically get the repository of exams of all the studies at UNED and all the subjects within the studies. Have you ever used this one? Yes.
Every day.
Every day. Oh my God. Okay. You work in UNED. Oh, okay. But in what part do you work?
I work in
Romadillo. Oh, okay. You work in Romadillo. Yeah. I was there in June. I had to do some level testing there. So you access the deposit every day for what reason?
Because I work in a program that helps people with visual for study.
Uh-huh. The people that have visual. Are you working on these?
No, this one.
Prison. Prisons.
Yeah.
I said.
So as they don't have access to this printing.
Oh, that's very nice.
We have to
print them and send them to them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very nice. It's one of your main tasks. Okay, so basically what you have here is a repertoire of everything that's that all the studies that exist in UNED. You would have to look for Estudios Ingleses. It's around here, isn't it?
No, the right.
On the right.
You don't
go in. Yeah. Okay, I can see it. Sorry? No, the answers aren't in commentary textos, they're not available. I teach a quiz in English. Ah, by the way, we have a C2 group that has very few students. So if you want to study English, we're starting next week, the quiz group for C2. This is very good for learning English and improving your English. And you get a discount for being UNED students. You get discuss in every single direction. It's a very small group, like 5 or 6 students in the group. And they're going to have it for sure because my student wants to have all the levels. So I would really recommend you to join if you're interested in improving your English. It's Fridays from 5 to 7. So I think it's a good way to
see
C2, yeah. Very good for your, English studies, students have to finish with a C1 level at least. I mean, if you're good at English and you want to practice, it's a great place to practice, it's a great, great place to start. If you're interested, I'm leaving it there. Okay, so, in the case of comentario textos literarios, there's one thing that you have to take into consideration. The PEC is identical to the exam. Identical. So, if you understand how the PEC works, you're going to understand how the exam works. If you have a look at the exam, you're going to see exactly the same structure that you're going to see in the PEC. So, if we click on the subjects, here are all the subjects that are available. It's all the subjects that you can take. You can see the exams from the previous years. I'm going to write this in the chat so Ricardo can have a look. And if I, for example, download, this is first week last year, identify one of the central ideas, and there it is, of grammatology. The critic should use devices to fix meaning. Textual limits should not be transcended. Knowledge of the historical context can shed light on a text. authors should have the final word on their texts. Do you dare give me an answer? The second one, the modern scripture is Barth's alternative to the texts which have been previously, which had previously been the main focus of attention. The reader, the receiver of the author's message. Author, viewed as the authoritative father of the text. Translator, who mediates between author and reader. So as you can see, this test is very important, because if you don't pass the test, you can't take the rest of the exam. So it's an eliminatory set of questions, and it's exactly the same for the PEC. The PEC, they're going to publish it, they told me this morning, in around 2 weeks and a half or something like that. And the exam itself, there's a fragment here. This is from The Awakening, I'm telling you. And what you would have to explain about it is the context. So you would have to say, Hey Chopin, The Awakening, American realism, end of the romanticism, whatever you want to talk about it. Conceptualizing the work incorrectly may be a cause for failing the part of the text analysis. Form and content. How is Edna characterized through her words in the dialogue? What do Robert and Leon say represent for her? This is also from the text. Theory and criticism. And here, as you can see, 70 words, 200 words. And there is a 1.5 marks and 0.5. So half of it is about the literary analysis, and half of the mark is about the theory and criticism. I think that the test it gives you 4 more points. Yes, 4 more points, and the PEC gives you 2. That's a lot of your. So if you don't take the PEC, you're severely limiting your options of passing the subject. Take the PEC. It's good work. You can work in groups and whatever. And the theory and criticism would be feminist criticism, exploring the power relationships. How are these obvious in the extract? What other aspects of the source text are interesting for feminist criticism? So as you can see, feminism takes up the entire exam in the first week. If we have a look at the second week of last year, you'll see that it goes in a completely different direction. Which of the following phrases best defines a post-structuralist approach to the text? Search for cohesive and unifying elements. Treat the text as a product of a superior mind. Study it along with a co-text. Read the text against itself, against the grain. This one is probably the easiest question I've seen in a very long time. Would you know the answer? Good exercise would be to try to do this, the ones that we've already seen, for the next day and see how prepared you are. Robert was there seated as he... Sorry? It's again The Awakening. Well, I mean, there's 2 novels and some poems. And since the pick is normally about Dylan Thomas's poem, or about Elizabeth Bishop's poem, because it's what you normally have time to cover by the time you have to do the pick, it makes sense, because it's the first part is analyzed in the pick. Second part is normally reserved for either The Awakening or Heart of Darkness, which are the big chunks of the second part of the subject. Robert was there seated as he had before. Again, from the Awakening, in another moment. Contextualize, form and content. It talks about how is Madame Rodinier characterized, and it says, discuss the vision of sexual identity as a social construct in relation to the extract. What other aspects of the source are interesting for feminist criticism? So one of the things that you could think about is maybe if all the exams from the from June were about feminism, most of the exams might be about post-colonialism in the second semester. So just think that that's a possibility. Okay, so I'll leave it there. And I just wanted you to have enough insight on that. I don't want to do a survey. Okay, so going back to this, what I said before, The differences between cultural materialism and new historicism and are basically centered, I think, on cultural materialism being much more political and about the focus of the context as very significant elements. There is a political characterization of new historicism, of course, but the comparison has more to do with analyzing the past and seeing whether it was fair or not. It is about analyzing the present, and therefore it's more open to discussion. I'm going to turn on the light, and we're going to do the study guide. Oh, I did that. So in the study guide from Unit 2, I want to direct your attention to the critical and literary theory parts on page 8, and we're going to start by talking about Hayden White, and reading from his essay from the historical text as a literary artifact. In general, there has been a reluctance to consider historical narratives as what they most manifestly are, verbal fictions, the contents of which, I don't know if you've seen which words are in bold, and if you can think about the reasons why they would be in bold. The contents of which are as much invented as they are found, and the forms of which have more in common with their counterparts in literature than they have with those in the sciences. Considered as potential elements of a story, historical events are value neutral, whether they find their place finally in a story that is tragic, comic, romantic, or ironic, depends upon the historian's decision to configure them according to the imperatives of one plot structure rather than another. The same set of events can serve as components of a story that is tragic or comic, as the case may be, depending on the historian's choice of plot structure that he considered most appropriate. The important point is that most historical sequences can be implotted in a number of different ways so as to provide different interpretations of those events and to endow them with different meanings. And if you understand what this means, that when we write about history, when history has been written, it's normally created with the same fictional value than when we create fiction as such. That there is a sense of that the historian's point of view is as important as the events that happen, because it's going to shape the narrative and it's going to make it more comical, more tragic, according to his own preference or to what is considered reasonable at the time. How a given historical situation is to be configured depends on the historian's subtlety in matching up a specific thought structure with a set of historical events he wishes to endow with a meaning of a particular kind. This is essentially a literary, that is to say, a fiction-making operation. In the process of studying a given set of events, the historian begins to perceive the possible story more that such events may figure. The reader, in the process of following the historian's account of those events, gradually comes to realize that the story he is reading is one kind rather than another. It is a romance, a tragedy, a comedy, a satire, an epic, or what have you. And when he has perceived the class or type to which the story that he is reading belongs, he experiences the effect of having the events in the story explained to him. He has at this point not only successfully followed the story, he has grasped the point of it, understood it.
This is what leads me to think that historical narratives are not only models of past events and processes, but also metaphorical statements which suggest a relation of similitude between such events and processes and the story types that we conventionally use to endow the events of our lives with culturally sanctioned meanings. The overall coherence of any given series of historical facts is the coherence of the story, but this coherence is achieved only by tailoring of the facts to requirements of the story form. A historical narrative does not image the things it indicates. It calls to mind images of the things it indicates in the same way that a metaphor does. When a given course of events is plotted as a tragedy, this simply means that the historian has so described the event as to remind us that that form of fiction which we associate with the concept tragedy. What all the this points to is the necessity of revising the distinction conventionally drawn between poetic and prose discourse in discussion of such narrative forms as historiography, and recognizing that the distinction, as old as Aristotle, between history and poetry obscures as much as it illuminates about both. The older distinction between fiction and history, in which fiction is conceived as a representation of the imaginable and history as a representation of the actual, must give place to the recognition that we can only know the actual by contrasting it with or likening it to the imaginable. Source: Norton Anthology of Theory and Criticism. I want you to work for a couple of minutes. I don't know if you've already done this at home. Mark the words that have an asterisk, narrative, story, plot, romance, tragedy, comedy, satire, epic, and discuss about a possible meaning, a definition for those words from your own understanding. You're going to do that now. The words with asterisk. Yes. What was your name? Your name was? Patricia. Patricia, how would you define narrative in your own words?
Narratives.
Let's listen to see if we agree. Narrative.
Documents,
okay, that's one possibility. Narrative, Andrea, right? Okay, Andrea?
Narrative, storytelling.
Okay, it's telling us some events or some. It can be fictional or factual, it can be about something historical,
or not. Any other extension of the definition? And the difference with a story? Is there a difference? Okay. Because you said narrative storytelling, then story? They sound different in your mind, no?
Yes. Okay. There's a difference I was going to explain it. Like, a narrative is like something like that actually happened,
mm-hmm.
like something real,
mm-hmm.
and a story doesn't necessarily have to be.
Okay, real. So you say that history would be more connected to narrative, not necessarily, but story is more fictional. Okay, yeah, it makes sense. It's correct. A plot. I'm sorry, what was your name?
Laura.
You said Patricia, no?
Yes.
Laura.
Plot, I think, is like the most important thing of a story or a text.
Okay. It would be like the key events or the most defining events of a story, okay? The answer says the pattern of events and situations in a narrative dramatic work. A romance is different in our current perspective than it was historically. What's a romance? And this is going to be very useful when you take, for example, American literature, or when you take I think you're already doing that, but you'll take a while to get to a romantic period. What's a romance?
For me, romance is about the story of the night in the middle of the...
Okay, it's basically an adventure. Okay, so it's an adventure. It's normally a narrative that has implicitly fantastic or non-realistic elements that seem like magical or unexplained within the events, mixed with things that seem factual or other elements that seem supernatural or surreal. Okay, so that's the basic structure of a romantic story, of a romance. Tragedy. Anyone to think it?
Well, it's a story that ends in a way, by the way.
Very good, yeah. A tragedy is normally the description or the events that lead to the fall of the hero. The central figure, the central character in the story is going to have a bad ending. There's going to be a bad outcome, a tragic outcome at the end for the main character. Okay, so what we see basically is the worst moment of a character, a comedy. Both tragedy and comedy are normally referred to as in theater, no, as plays. What's a comedy more typically?
Like, I think it's used as a way to criticize current.
That would be satire. Okay, that would be satire. Comedy would be a way of expressing a situation that might seem serious, but that very soon is illustrated through a humorous perspective that makes the audience connect with the story, but from the point of view of feeling an emotional uplift. So it's made for entertainment purposes and also to illustrate. Sometimes it can have a satirical aspect, but when it's used as a way to subvert and criticize something, it's more of a satire than simply a comedy. So we've already covered satire. The answers say, referring to a comedy, a play or other literary composition written chiefly to amuse the audience by appealing to a sense of superiority over the characters depicted. Comedy will normally be closer to the representation of everyday life than a tragedy, and will explain common human failings rather than tragedies, disastrous crimes. Its ending will usually be happy for the leading characters. So comedy is lighter to watch and to experience because we know that the ending is going to have like a sort of happy ending. We like happy endings, so it's something that suits most tastes. The satire is a mode of writing that exposes the failing of individuals or society at the institutions and to ridicule and scorn them. And finally, an epic. Can you think of what is the central epic in Spanish literature?
Like a story, maybe.
Okay. Okay, heroes. Yes, it would be like a hero quest, and we experience the life of a hero throughout the narrative. For example, Miltiades is the epitome of an epic, of a Spanish epic. Okay. Yes. Beowulf is another example. So, for example, sometimes we have mixes of these types. If we have a look at Don Quixote, in certain ways it's a satire disguised as an epic, and mixing the styles, we get different literary forms. Okay, in terms and expressions, it says, briefly think what you mean, verbal fictions, in paragraph one, verbal fictions. Historical narratives are mostly verbal fictions. Why would it say something like that? Because normally a historian was not sitting on a mountaintop in the forest of Germany, of the current Germany, to see the Roman invasion of the Germanic tribes. It was basically the facts that she has compiled through other people that told the story before him, the archaeological evidence, his own imagination, and he creates a story. So what he says with that, most historical accounts have to do more with literature than with facts, or have to do as much as with literature as with facts. So that's why he's saying, careful with history, because history, we take it as fact, and we should probably take it as mostly fiction. Okay, so this is what this verbal fiction means. Value neutral. The context is considered as potential elements of a story. Historical events are value neutral. The answer key says, White is saying here that historical events acquire narrative value only after the historian organizes them into a specific plot type, as a story that is tragic, comic, or romantic. Before that, their narrative value is potential and neutral. So the facts are neutral, but it's the historian that creates a narrative using those elements. Because at the end of the day, even a historian wants you to read the history book. So it's his job to create a narrative that fits the taste of the readers. Implotted, organized into a plot. Okay? Fiction making. The significance that certain historical events and how they match with a precise plot. It says fiction making, where is it? A fiction making operation. So he says that, White says that historical events are more literary than historical. And finally, tailoring. Tailoring is like personalidad, okay, or hacer a medida. It's adapting the facts to a particular story form. So when she says it here, this coherence is achieved only by tailoring of the facts to the requirements of the story form. How many times have we read that there is a new study that reveals that something that we took for granted was actually very different in the past? That's because sometimes when we have to conclude an essay or write of history or write about history, the facts have to match. And if they don't match, sometimes we try to make them match, even if it's not 100% accurate. So why the same? This destroys the credibility of all historians. So I'm sure that historians as well as scholars do not love to read Hayden White's version of what history was doing. It's highly aggressive towards the profession of a historian. Okay? So you have a bundle of script behind your chair. Weird. Okay, I'm going to read before we finish. Okay, we have 15 minutes. Stephen Greenblatt, Greenblatt, I always say that name wrong. Partial text from Shakespearean criticism. As you can see, Shakespeare is widely used as a starting point for literary criticism because it's so wide and it's so widely known that it normally provides a lot of space for almost every literary theory. So most literary theory books, not this one especially, but for example, the one I used when I was a student, focus on Shakespearean work because it's so full of variety, the body of work of Shakespeare, that it allows for a lot of interpretation and normally contrasting interpretation. From the introduction to The Power of Forms in English Renaissance, 1988. As you can see, all of these theories are quite current. I am Richard II, know you not that, exclaimed Queen Elizabeth on August the 4th, 1601, in the wake of the abortive Essex Rising. On the day before the rising, someone had paid the Lord Chamberlain's men 40 shillings. I don't know if you know that the Lord Chamberlain's men was Shakespeare's company. That's the way they were called, the Lord Chamberlain's men. To revive their old play about the deposing and killing of Richard II. So what this is saying from the very start is that theater by no means is only entertainment. Sometimes theater and literature is as powerful politically as any other weapon. And therefore, you can never take a literary text as innocent and only intended for amusement. Even the most innocent looking of the pieces can have a very strong political intent. We saw that with Elizabeth Bishop's poem that seemed like a funny description of a set of elements on a desk. And we saw that there was a very strong political connotation, political criticism against imperialist movements and against the colonialist practices in the Far East. So Queen Elizabeth, when she was in danger of being deposed and executed, said, "I'm Richard II, don't you know that?" It's like she was rebelling against, or she was complaining that she was in that mess because of Shakespeare's fault, and because of Shakespeare's company fault, because they had represented a play that was too overt in giving ideas of how to depose and execute a king and why you should do that. In the case of Richard II. I guess that for Queen Elizabeth, it was quite uncomfortable to watch some of these plays because it was basically about the family tree, most of the story. So I guess it wasn't the most comfortable thing to watch. As far as we know, the play almost certainly is Shakespeare's. It was performed only once at the Globe. But in Elizabeth's bitter recollection, this tragedy was played 40 times in open streets and houses. The story of Richard II was obviously a highly charged one in a society where political discussion was conducted with deviousness. Clearly, it is not the text alone that bears the full significance of Shakespeare's play, but rather the story's full situation. The genre, it is thought to embody the circumstances of its performance, the imaginings of its audience that governs its shifting. 40 times in open streets and houses for the queen, the repeatability of the tragedy and hence the number of people who have been exposed to its infection is part of the danger, along with her conviction that the plague had broken out, of the boundaries of the playhouse, where such stories are clearly marked as powerful allusions and moved into the more volatile zone, the zone she calls open of the streets. Modern historical scholarship has assured Elizabeth that she has nothing to worry about Richard about. Richard II is not at all subversive, but rather a hymn to Tudor order. According to John Dover Wilson, the play, far from encouraging thoughts of rebellion, regards the deposition of the legitimate king as a sacrilegious act that drags a country down into the abyss of chaos. But in 1601, neither Queen Elizabeth nor the Earl of Essex were so sure. After all, someone on the eve of a rebellion thought the play sufficiently seditious to warrant squandering £2 on the players, and the Queen understood the performance as a threat. So is one of the criticisms that Stephen Greenblatt is throwing out on the table is saying it's very easy to analyze from your dimlit study in a university that Richard II was not seditious and that nobody had anything to worry. But in 1601, the people that witnessed it had a lot of reasons to worry. So he's being extremely ironic in saying that modern scholars don't realize the fact that it was absolutely disturbing at the time because it was put within the context of the time. And that now we're understanding it, reading it in isolation. And that when you read it in isolation, you read it in a broken manner. And that you need to bring in the context, the context. So the idea of context, I think that you can understand it as a context. Everything that surrounds the play or the literary works and that makes it real. When you read Elizabeth Bishop out of the blue, you say, okay, weird poem. I don't know if I like it or I don't like it. Maybe I like it, maybe I don't. When you read it next to Mary McCarthy's war report, you say, wow, this is very powerful. The poem really hits on the nail on the head, but without even needing to mention Vietnam throughout the entire poem, because it speaks so bad about imperialist poem that I can, about imperialist power, that I can refer to this poem as being Vietnam, as being Somalia, as being Afghanistan, as being Syria, as being any area where the superpowers go in just to take the loot, and they destroy the life of the people, and they treat them as mere spectators of the tragedy in their country, and then they leave. Okay, so I think that's what's so powerful, to understand a text within the context, within the surrounding context that are around it. How can we account for the discrepancy between Dover Wilson's historical reconstruction and the anxious response of the figures whose history he purports to have accurately reconstructed? Dover Wilson's historical research has the effect of conferring autonomy and fixity upon the text, and it is precisely this fixity that is denied by Elizabeth's response. Dover Wilson's work is a distinguished example of the characteristic assumptions and methods of the mainstream literary history practiced in the first half of our century. The new historicism is set apart from both the dominant historical scholarship of the past. The earlier historicism tends to be monological. That is, it is concerned with discovering a single political vision, usually identical to that said to be held by the entire literate class, or indeed the entire population. Okay? It's a bit monothematic. This vision, most often presumed to be internally coherent and consistent, has the status of a historical fact. It is not thought to be the product of the historian's interpretation. This vision can serve as a stable point of reference. Literature is conceived to mirror the period's belief from a safe distance. So, what this part is saying is that there is a general perspective, and I think that we say this nowadays, that time gives you perspective. Time gives you perspective, but maybe it also eliminates the urgency of the moment and all the situations surrounding, because when we focus our attention, on a limited set of items. We can't focus our attention on everything. Maybe because we can't, his sleep. We don't want it because only this part of the story matches what we want to tell. Because we have a historic, we have a fictional intent. We want to create a story that is coherent. So this way of seeing history as one unique way and it being different to the response that it created in its own time is a blatant example of what new historicism criticizes. Here, it's very clear. And I think this is why new historicism had a lot of appeal to the readership of the time, because it really exposed situations that everybody says, I understand this, this makes sense. I am able to understand this. For example, when you saw Mary McCarthy's poem and the war report, you said, I understand what this means. When we were studying post-structuralism, it was almost a matter of believing what I was saying. You interpreted it in the text, it wasn't so clear. Here there is less theory and more, I understand it with my own eyes. I'm able to come to the same conclusions as the scholars arrive. So let's wrap this up. The new historicism erodes the firm ground of post-criticism and literature. It tends to ask questions about its own methodological assumptions and those of others. In the present case, for example, it might encourage us to examine the ideological situation not only of Richard II, but of Dover Wilson on Richard II. Moreover, recent criticism has been less concerned to establish the organic unity of literary works and more open to such works as Places of Dissent and Shifting Interest, occasions for the jostling of orthodox and subversive impulses, the Elizabethan Playhouse, Playwright and Player, writes Louis Adrian Montrose, exemplify the contradictions of Elizabethan society and make those contradictions their subject. If the world is a theater and the theater is an image of the world, then by reflecting upon its own artifice, the drama is holding the mirror up to the nature. Okay, so I hope that reading the two critical essays, you come to a better understanding. I think that in this case, it's fairly easy to this unit is easier to understand than the previous unit. I want to remind you that you have to advance as quick as possible reading The Awakening. How far have you gotten? You finished it, no? You read it before the course? Have you started? Oh my gosh. Have you started, Loda? No? You started it?
Yes,
again?
I started that.
Not so much, okay. Try to get it read by, 3 weeks from now. Because I want to deal with it at the beginning of December. So I'm going to go over all the theory to give you time and weeks in the middle. And I think it's also going to help you when producing the text. Okay, so thanks a lot. Have a fantastic week. Thanks a lot, Ricardo.